Hi, everyone. I'm Sonia. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Welcome to the Valley Group speaker meeting. We have a really good treat for you guys tonight. We have Terry from Fresno with 14 years of sobriety. So I got a chance to speak with Terry, and she said, every day sober is a gift from God. I think we need to remember that here in AA. I asked her what her secret is to 14 years of sobriety. And not only did she say like the one day at a time thing, she said the conscious contact with God is that secret to sobriety. Her philosophy is to unify with the message of AA found only in the Big Book. Her message to the newcomer is to reach out to a sponsor immediately. This is a life and death situation. So when, if you're a newcomer and when you see the people raising their hands and they're able to sponsor, please take note of that immediately and get that assistance. She says, we in AA are a kind and loving group, and we are here to help. So I would like to go ahead and welcome our speaker, Terry from Fresno with 14 years of sobriety.
Thank you so much. Yes, I am Terry, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And my home group is Home Group Fellowship in Fresno. And it's a 7-day-a-week fellowship and a women's meeting Sundays at 4. And it's a good place to go. That's where I first came and didn't stay there the whole time, but I'm there now. And we'll get to all that. So the challenge for me is to do this talk in the amount of time that I'm given, because it's really a workshop. It's stuff that would be the contents of a workshop. So just know with me that God's got this, and I can condense things really, really good, I hope. So a little bit about my background. I did not grow up thinking that I want to be an alcoholic when I grow up and I want to come in these rooms and do the things that I do today. None of that was in my consciousness. I grew up in what I thought was a fairly normal family. Now that I've done a ton of work, pretty dysfunctional, honestly, but I didn't know that then. And when I was little, things that appealed to me were things that probably didn't appeal to normal little kids. I was born in 1964, so easy to do the math, but I grew up at a time where it was a hippie generation, and there was a lot of drugs and alcohol in places that I was at. There was going to peace rallies. There were just a lot of things that may not be the best influence on a child. And the thing, what was so crazy is that I thought it was just the coolest thing in the world. I could really, really relate to people making homemade wine and big balloons off the top of the bubbles. And this is as a little kid before I've ever put anything in my body. These are the things that were attractive to me. These were the things that, like, man, they look like they're having so much fun. I want to grow up and be just like that. And I kind of sought that, and I did that. The things that I didn't understand is that there was something going on inside of me before I ever put booze in this body, and that was a separation from higher power, if you will. I'll try to use real neutral language tonight, but from a higher power. And I had no idea that I felt that way. I know today that most children aren't like that. Probably most people in this room, I'm going to guess, are. That I felt different. I felt alone. I felt separate in my own family. I felt different. I felt like I didn't fit in. And I spent a lot of my lifetime trying to fit into something that was never going to be a fit. It was never, ever, ever going to work. There's a lot of things that happened in my childhood. There was, you know, sexual abuse. There was the drinking and the drugging and all that crap. You know, these are all things that, as a result of doing these steps, I can say it with that type of neutrality. The 10th step tells us we're put in a position of neutrality, and we're not just talking about booze. We're talking about a position of neutrality toward life. I can face life from a neutral place. I think the very first time, well, when I was a little kid, my dad had a philosophy. My parents divorced, and I lived with my mom, but I was with my dad all the time, too. But he had a philosophy that what I don't know won't hurt me. So already having the mentality that I had, I ran with that. It seemed like a really good idea that means I can do whatever the hell I want, and I did. And I remember being at parties, and us kids would be sneaking beers and, you know, getting intoxicated, and I don't have like, oh, I finally found the answer. It wasn't like that. It was fun. It was just fun. I remember I lied to my dad and I told him I'd smoked pot, and that was an invitation for him to smoke pot with me. I did it to, one more time, fit in, be cool, be accepted by my dad, to have that parental acceptance. I remember my mom, and she remarried, they'd be in the bathroom smoking pot like I didn't know what that was, and smelling it, reeking out of the bathroom, and my sister and I just laughing at the ridiculousness of them. I remember being at my very first concert, and it was Blue Oyster Cult way back in the early 70s, and I remember we were on the floor partying, and my mom was up in the stands partying, you know, and just no conversation about this is not acceptable, this is not the way you raise children, this is not okay. And I know that today. I certainly didn't know it then. I thought it was wonderful, you know, this is really, really cool. I would say that I became a regular drinker probably by ninth grade. I remember I was at Hamilton, and back then they put all of us ninth graders in one school because they had no idea what to do with us, and because we didn't fit with the seventh graders and we didn't fit with the seniors, so they had a school and they tried it for a couple of years and it didn't work. But I remember we would mix these big old huge concoctions of alcohol, and we'd have them in our locker, and we'd be getting stoned and drunk before class out in the alley, and it was just absolutely wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. There was absolutely nothing wrong with what I was doing in ninth grade. As I got a little bit older, like maybe 10th grade, seriously, things started happening. Things were a little bit different. What I realized is that I wasn't drinking like other people. I was getting really, really, really drunk, and other people weren't. Other people were able to have okay behavior, and I was having unacceptable behavior. I didn't think so at the time, because I just thought I was a party girl. I thought I was just, I'm the fun one. I don't know what the heck's wrong with all these people. And that went on for a little while, till 11th grade. And during that time between in 10th and 11th grade both, there were a lot of incidents of me unable to come home on time, unable to meet my curfew. And today I know why. It's a real simple reason. I was unable to come home, and I was hurting my parents over and over and over by this behavior. And I remember thinking, if it ever happens again, I'm just going to have to leave because I can't keep hurting my parents. And what I know today from a recovered position is that I was in the midst of a horrible, horrible physical allergy. I would be at a kegger. See if any of you can relate to this. I'd be at a kegger, and it'd be time to go home. But I had a dilemma because there was still beer in that keg. Therefore, I can't go home because I'm in the midst of an allergy that I can't control. For decades, I told myself I was a rebel. I told myself I'm this and I'm that. That's not the truth. The truth is I'm an alcoholic, and I was in the middle of a physical obsession beyond my control. There was absolutely nothing I could have done anything different but stay there and drink that beer. I couldn't. I didn't have the power to do anything different. And looking back at that, that's part of the truth that we find out when we're doing this work. And fast forward a lot of years. I remember when I was in my 30s, I had a friend and we were drinking buddies, and I had a child in between that time, but then I had another child in my early 30s, and we were drinking buddies, and we all had little children, and she got arrested and quit drinking. And that might be the first time that I consciously wanted to not drink. And I was like, wow, we should quit drinking. And so that page you guys read, which I love, on page 31 with all the different things that we try, I tried a lot of those. My main thing was exercise. And what I know today is that I had a moment of grace from God. I didn't do that. I can't do that. I could never do that. I don't have the power to not drink. Just like today, I don't have the power to drink, which is a really cool thing we'll talk about later. But what was really cool was I had that moment of grace where God did separate me from booze, and I didn't know. Well, I did. I knew about AA. I didn't go to AA. I tried some of those other things. I used massive exercise and health because I was really, really unhealthy at this time. Really, really unhealthy already. So I'm going to back up for just a second. When I was in my early 20s, I was using other substances, and I'm really trying to keep it focused on what we do here. I was using other substances, and I tried to go to NA to stay out of prison. Didn't work. So at that point in time, I was really, really clear when I got out that I absolutely cannot do those other things. But man, if you knew my life, I have to drink. There's nothing wrong with drinking. And that was the belief that I held for a number of years. And that time that I didn't drink, that God separated me in my early 30s, was very interesting. And I'll tell you why. Because I got sicker. I got sicker internally, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I thought I was just a bitch. That's not the case. That's not the case. I was untreated. I was having a horrible, horrible, untreated alcoholism. Unbelievable. Remove booze, I get worse. Remove booze, I get crazy. Remove booze, I get really, really mean and hateful. Add booze, that's what keeps me functioning at the time until it stops doing that. And so there was nothing wrong, and I love the stories where we're talking about the mental obsession, not a cloud in the sky. I'm a mountain girl. I love the mountains. I love hiking. I love everything about being in the mountains. I was camping. Everything was fine. And the thought came to me that it'd be really nice to have a whiskey. And I was with my dad, and so there was booze. And so in a 32-ounce cup, I made a whiskey that was about, I don't know, two-thirds whiskey and one-third soda. And it was amazing, and nothing happened. Worked so good, I had another one. And guess what? Nothing happened. I felt it. I justified it. When people asked me, oh, you're drinking? Yeah. I was making too much of it before. I don't know what the big deal was. Here's the crazy thing that happened. Some people say that they can go on like that, and they can get by like that for a month. They can get on like that for 60 days, whatever. Not this girl. By the very next day, when my husband arrived, he had brought lots of beer, and I proceeded to drink probably just under 30 beers. And the next day, I had absolutely no recollection of how I had not drank all that time. That idea of how that had happened was not in my consciousness. And today I know why, because I had been separated by God. That was a God thing. It had nothing to do with my power. That's why I didn't know how to do that, nor do I know how to do that today. Yes, I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body, but all the rest is off. If I were to drink, everything is exactly the same as it always had been. And in my case, and in my experience, it gets worse. It gets much, much, much worse. So at this time, I'm probably, I don't know, 33, 34. And after this time, I tried to stop a lot of times and couldn't. My book makes very, very clear that, you know, one of the things is, you know, a lot of people can stop, but they can't stay stopped. I could stop. I could have alcohol poisoning so bad that I would come to in the morning, and I wouldn't drink for 24 hours, and I would look at you and tell you, see, I can skip a day. And I honestly believe that. I believe that in my heart of hearts, that was my truth. I really, really, really believe that. And then there would be other times where I would say, I would come to, today's going to be different. Today I'm not going to drink. And I would find myself at the liquor store and honestly have no recollection how that happened, how I got there. And it would be like, what the hell, I'm just going to do it anyway, I'm here. And have no idea how I got there. other times that happened during that time period was waking up and looking around my room and seeing food containers and not remember leaving my house and being terrified and going out and looking at my car and looking for hair or blood. This was a reality. This was like a regular thing that occurred, waking up and not knowing, you know, how did this get here? Or coming to in the morning and there's a freaking full bottle of whiskey because I needed just a little bit more before I passed out, and no recollection. How did that get here? How did I do it? But I know how I did it. I drove. And speaking of driving, I had children. Driving drunk was a normal thing. And the book talks about we have moral convictions galore, but we can't live up to them. So I had all these ideas of how life should be, how I wanted to be, what it should look like, and there wasn't a single one of those I could pull off. There was absolutely nothing I could pull off. And driving with my children in the car is one of the main number one things that I look back and I go, yep, I did that, and I did that on a nearly daily basis, and didn't think anything of it. There were many, many, many other things with my children that, again, if we had a workshop, I would want to spend about 10 minutes on this, because I'm sure we have a lot of parents in here, but we don't. So I continued to try to get sober. I continued to have it be different. At 41 years old, I went to the library because I remembered them NA people, and I sure didn't like them because they said stupid things. They had stupid stuff hanging on their walls. They had stupid sayings. They were happy. They were clean. They were hugging. They did so many things that was just horrible to me, because my whole thing was, I am so separate from God that I'm going to push every single one of you away from me, and I'm going to keep you there. I'm going to do that with my mean face and my mean attitude and my mean boy being, and it worked really, really good. But I knew that AA was here, and I called. Well, no, I got to back up. Don't want to skip that funny part. So I went to the library, and I checked out a big book because I did not want to go to them damn meetings. So I'm laying there, sicker than a dog, totally detoxing, and I'm reading the doctor's opinion, and this was my very, very, very first spiritual experience, which is extremely different than a spiritual awakening. My first spiritual experience was having the intuitive thought, which I know is higher power, saying, you're going to have to go to those meetings, girl. And the next thought was, oh, shit, my life is over. And you know what? It's a damn good thing my life is over, because what has happened since I came in was I've had many sponsors. I've had a lot of sponsors. And at two and a half, three years sober, I was batshit crazy. I was completely untreated. I had been through the steps. I went to big book meetings, and I was sick. I was sick in AA, and I don't know if anybody can relate to that, but let me tell you, it is a scary, scary feeling, because if this doesn't work, I'm screwed. What else is there? I am screwed. And I found some people that actually worked straight out of the big book, that did the steps as they're designed and as it's laid out in the big book. And I did that. And what I saw was that my life started to really, really change. A lot of things good had happened before. I mean, really good things. I'd gotten a job that I shouldn't have gotten because I had a felony. And it's a God thing. I was able to work with people with developmental disabilities. But that's only by the grace of God. And I was a horrible, horrible manager. I told God, just don't let me be in charge. AA says I can't be in charge. So I get a job being in charge. And I was horrible. I was horrible because I was untreated. I was mean and disrespectful, and I didn't really care about anybody. And the way that I know today is I was so separate from God. So I'm going to fast forward a lot because I hate looking at that clock right now. There's so much to say. So what has happened in the time that I've been in AA? So I stayed at that job for 9 years. And then it became objectionable because I became a good manager. The book in the 11th step talks about that we have to allow God to discipline us. And that's what I had done. By doing the work, I let God discipline me on how I need to be and how I'm supposed to show up and treat other people. And that job became objectionable because management was judging people based on tattoos, piercings, et cetera, et cetera. I have a gazillion tattoos. It was objectionable. And what I believe is that we have the power when we're tapped in to manifest things in our life. And I manifest getting fired. And when she was sitting there across from me firing me, I thought, oh, good, I don't have to stay to 4:30. Okay, that is not a normal thought. That is not a thought that a person that lives a fear-based life has. That is a person that has a faith-based life. I had enough money in the bank to be able to play for 7 months. I did some miraculous things. I went backpacking in the Grand Canyon for 6 days. I was able to do things that I would never, ever, ever thought I could do. Way back in the first step, where they're being really, really convincing that this is a life and death thing. And, you know, the first part is that physical allergy that I described with the keg. The other one is the mental obsession. These are the only two things that qualify us as alcoholics. I know there's cool pamphlets and stuff laying around. That doesn't qualify you as an alcoholic. DUIs does not qualify you. DTs do not qualify you. It's these two qualifications, and one is that physical craving that when you start drinking, you can't stop. The second is the mental obsession, and that is something inside of this broken alcoholic mind that tells this girl, this time it's going to be different. This time you're going to drink like a lady. This time you're only going to have 6 or 4 or 10 or whatever it is. And I can never, ever, ever get to that mark, because then I'm in the middle of that physical allergy. And if this doesn't make sense, please reach out to these people that raised their hand. Talk to a sponsor. Talk to me after this meeting, because these are key. Because if you're not an alcoholic, you don't got to do this shit that I got to do, because I got to do this stuff every day. So I'm going to tell you guys a lot of stuff right now that has happened since then. When I first came into AA, the last thing in the world that I wanted, I was okay with higher power, but I didn't want to hear about Jesus. I didn't want to hear about religion. I didn't want to hear much about God. I didn't want to hear much about any of that, because that's not what resonated with me. What resonated with me was being in the woods and being in connection with trees and plants and rocks. That's what worked for me. So just the thought, when people would start talking about Jesus in a meeting, I would just go, oh my God, get me out of here. So I have to tell you that to tell you what happened. I had a friend. He's still my friend. He was a pain in the ass. And he had a hard time staying sober, but I love him anyway. And he would give me these books. And these books were not AA-approved literature. And these were books about spiritual things, which is all the 11th step. We want to see what religious people have to offer. So these people don't consider themselves religious. They're spiritual. But anyway, so I start putting these on my shelf, actually, for a little while. Maybe about a year and a half they sat on my shelf. And then I was going to go camping one time, and I grabbed one, and it was an Eckhart Tolle book. So I'm reading it, and things in there resonated with me. It started making sense. And a lot of different things happened, but I ended up at a spiritual center. And at this spiritual center, I started taking classes because I wanted more. And this all happened over a long period of time. It's not like I walked in and signed up. Believe me, I did not do that, because that's not how my relationship with God came to be. My relationship to God came piecemeal. Our book talks about that William James has a part that discusses the education of variety. This is real important. And that some people have a burning bush. Well, here's what I know, and this is what I think about Bill, one of our co-founders, and this is what I think about people that have burning bush experiences. I think that they are spiritual experiences. I don't think they're a spiritual awakening. And if we look at our history, Bill got really sick in AA as a result of never doing the steps, plain and simple. You know, and believe me, I love our founders, but that's just a fact. I believe we all have educational variety, which means we give a little teeny bit, and then we can trust God, and then a little bit more, and we can trust God a little bit more. We have an awakening as a result of doing the steps. We make our first amends, and that's a spiritual experience. And then we were able to be on the spiritual path more. Because regardless of how uncomfortable this is a spiritual program. It's a very, very spiritual program, and the book lays that out from the very, very, very beginning. We're not supposed to shy away from talking about that part of the program. And that's why I shared my experience with hating this part of the program when I came in. So I started started taking these classes and things started to change in my life. Things started happening. And when I say all this, I'm saying this is what happens as a spiritual awakening, as a result of all of the steps, as a result of finishing all of my amends. That means every single last amends that was on that list, I have made that amends. I have done the hard footwork of doing the steps. They're simple in concept. They're hard to pull off. As a result of doing the 10th step, which is a daily checking in on myself all the time, 11th step, doing the morning directions, following the nightly review every single night, sending it to others. So I'm sharing this with other people to hold me accountable, and I hold them accountable. We were laughing on the way that we have a tribe of women that we hold each other accountable for what we need to do. But going back to what it's like now, well, what it was, this is kind of in the middle still too, but I took a lot of classes, and way during this time in the classes, I ended up getting I'm a licensed practitioner, a licensed spiritual practitioner, and it doesn't matter where this is from, none of that even matters. And a brother of mine in AA asked me, are you going to go on? And I go, no, I'm so done. I'm tired. I don't want to read any more books. I just want to just be. And he said, you know, it's just one more step in your spiritual journey. And I can't argue with that. I cannot argue with the fact that this is a spiritual journey. And until I'm dead, there's more work. Which also goes back to AA, that I also believe that that we work the steps more than one time. I work the steps about every year. Sometimes it varies, and I know that sounds ridiculous and a lot, but I have to because I'm a real alcoholic, and I have to. The book talks about fitting ourselves. So what does fit mean? Fit means staying spiritually fit, fitting myself to be a maximum service to God and others. Well, who are the others? Does that mean I can only be of service to you people, to my people? Nope. Not for this girl. Each one of us it's something different for each one of us. Some people, it might be just the people in AA. I was talking to one of my brothers before the meeting. He got called to help children. It's going to look different. He's being a maximum service to God and others. And his story was with children. That's fabulous. So I went on and I took some more classes. And this past summer, I just finished those classes. And I'm actually an ordained minister now, which blows my mind. No. Please don't clap, because it isn't me. It's God. And anytime these things happen, what we always say is, go God. I did not do this. God did this. All I could do is put one foot in front of the other foot. And, you know, I don't even like one day at a time. I don't want to stay sober one day at a time. If I had to white knuckle one day at a time, I would be batshit crazy again. I want to stay sober for good and all. And that's from Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob, for good and all. I want to stay sober forever. So how do I do that? I have to have the tools. I have to figure out what that looks like. I have to understand that no matter what I do, AA is my foundation, and it better be rock solid. There better not be any stones out of place. There better not be anything that got worn down from rain. In our case, stinking thinking, right? There can't be anything that gets worn down. That can't happen to me, because I know the consequences. I have been untreated in sobriety. It sucks. I have been untreated since I became a recovered alcoholic. That really sucks, because when you know better, you know, you do better. But then sometimes I don't. Because sometimes I get tired and I get lazy, and maybe I don't want to do that nightly review for a couple days in a row, or my ego gets in the way. I don't want to make that amends to somebody because I don't want to be wrong. There has to come a point in time in this girl's life where I don't care if I'm wrong anymore, because I would rather be sober and have my connection with God. That's the most important thing. So I want to spend these last few minutes talking about something that is really, really, really dear to me, and that is sponsorship. So I know a lot of people that have sobriety, and it's almost like, I got mine, I'm good, now I'm going to go live my life. And I can promise you, that is not AA. That's not what it's about. In our book, if you have an older edition, we have it had a circle and triangle. You should all draw a circle and triangle in your book if you don't have it, because it should be there. And that means there's three sides to this AA thing, and we need to be in all three sides. And the first side is recovery, and I already talked about that. That is that rock solid foundation that I am responsible for my recovery. I am powerless over alcohol, and I'm powerless over a lot of things too. But as a result of these steps and having a spiritual awakening, I am tapped into a power that is magnificent. I am not the power. I will never be the power. But I am tapped into a power that I can use and direct to have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I do. Who would have thought? I'm going to get paid to do this. People are going to pay me to listen to me. Holy shit. That blows my mind. Tattoos and all. The next part is the service. And when we're talking about the service part of the triangle, we're not talking about the steps. We're talking about the home group. We have to have a home group that we're a part of. We have to have a home group that we're responsible to and that is responsible to us. And I have not always thought that was important. It's not in the big book. I'll say that. But what it does is I have to have a place that I go. I have to have a place to go find my newcomers, which brings me to the last part of the triangle. And that's the unity side. And like my dear sister over here said, you know, unity is really, really, really important to me. And there is only one message, and that's the message in the big book, period. There's one message. That's the message, and that's what you need to unify with. So I need to unify that when I'm speaking. I need to unify that in the meeting. And most importantly, I need to carry this message to the newcomer and sit across the table, one alcoholic helping another alcoholic. I do this all the time. I work with many, many women. All these little sheets in here, these are all my women. This is where they're at. I also work with men. I don't have any men right now because our book doesn't say anything about differentiating at all. One alcoholic working with another alcoholic, period. And I'm sure that blows a lot of people's mind, like, what the hell is she talking about? But it's by experience, one alcoholic with another alcoholic. There may be things in a fifth step that would be more appropriate for me not to hear, and I would suggest them, a man, to go to maybe a more appropriate recovered male alcoholic. But that doesn't mean the rest of the work can't happen. The sponsorship is so unbelievably important, and the fabulous thing that happens is we get to see a fellowship grow up about us. We get to see people that I sponsor start to sponsor, they get to start to sponsor, and we get to see this whole lineage of people that, and I have a sponsor, so I forgot to say that, I usually say that first. We get to see this happen. We get to see this unfoldment of AA just the way they did it in the beginning, just the way Bill and Bob did it. We get to see how the two of them went to Bill Dobbs and how they went to AA number 4, 5, 6, on and on and on. And we get to carry on that beautiful thing. Unfortunately, our recovery rate is not good right now. And a big part of that are big changes that happened in the 70s with a lot of therapy and things like that. And so that is why this idea of unity is so important to me, that we need to just unify around this one solid message. And as recovered alcoholics, I believe that we have a moral obligation, and I think those are more the words like Dr. Bob would use, a moral obligation to give what was so freely given to us back to the new suffering alcoholic. Because I don't know about the rest of you, I remember what it felt like to walk in this room. I remember what it felt like to have just a couple days. And it's hard for me. I can feel it right now saying that out loud. I hope every single person in this room remembers what that felt like. What we have today is a gift from God. We are only sober by the grace of God, no matter what you believe or don't believe. That's the only reason we're sober. I can't do this on my own. I tried for years and years and years and years to do something different. So again, I just have to say it one more time. If you're new, and there seems like there's quite a few people with not too much sobriety, I just want to leave people with, if you're new and don't have a sponsor, get a sponsor tonight. Seriously, get a sponsor. Say, please help me. I don't want to die. And for people with 5 years or less, this is a challenge that was given to me. Don't get comfortable in AA. Don't get comfortable. Don't think you got this thing. We don't got this thing. I don't got this thing. That's why I got to keep doing this. That's why I do everything this book says today as much as when I was desperate. Maybe even more so. Because now I know the real reality. Now I know I'm not a rebel. I know all these truths that are my truth, all these things about myself that really... I was a scared little girl when I came in here. I was terrified of you, and that's why I needed to push you away. I didn't have God. I thought I had God. And I don't want anyone to have to live like that, because we have the ability to direct and use this power that is greater than us to continue this beautiful lineage of helping one alcoholic help another. So I'm out of time. Thank you.